Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Smith. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, along with Major Grace Gallagher, on behalf of the appellant, Sergeant Michael Smith. In assessing the legality of orders Colonel Winthrop wrote, where the order is apparently regular and lawful on its face, the soldier is not to go behind it to satisfy that his superior has proceeded with authority. The only exceptions recognized to this rule of obedience being cases so manifestly beyond the legal power or discretion of the commander to admit of no rational doubt as to their unlawfulness. The inferior should presume that the order was lawful and authorized and obey it accordingly.
What order are you talking about here?
The order regarding setting the conditions for the detainee.
This is count three.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what was the precise order that the appellant was given and by whom? And where in the record is that reflected?
The precise order that was given is not reflected exactly what he was told to do. It is clear that Colonel Pappas authorized for at least one day detainee, according to his testimony, to use the dogs to set conditions for interrogations. According to his testimony, that was not this day detainee. However, under the Joint Appendix 159-160, the trial defense counsel, pursuant to cross-examination, asked Colonel Pappas if he permitted actually for Al-Qaeda or ASHI to be interrogated.
So far, it sounds like a pretty confusing order. The military judge said in aid of interrogation. Is that not the order that appellant says he was received?
That's correct, Your Honor.
What was the order appellant says he received, and from whom?
From this record, it appears that he received an authorization from Colonel Pappas to use his dogs to set conditions.
Under what conditions?
Under what conditions?
Right. Muzzle or no muzzle? Certain distance?
There's a lot of contradictory testimony about
the. Is there testimony from which the fact finder could have found that Pappas said, muzzle the dogs and keep them 15 feet away?
From which the fact finder could have found that muzzle the dogs and keep them
15 feet away? Was part of the order.
That's right, Your Honor, there is that. But there's also testimony from others, Major Danina, Sergeant Aston, Sergeant Hampton, all said you wouldn't keep dogs muzzled in that condition. And in the hard site at this
were they the persons giving the order? Nadina and...
Well, that's also confusing, Your Honor, because, first of all, Pappas says he doesn't even remember giving the order.
What's your
case.
Best evidence in the record that appellant received an order from Colonel Pappas to use his dog to, in some manner, in relation to the interrogation?
Joint Appendix 159 and 160, Your Honor.
Say again.
Joint Appendix 159 and 160, and Joint Appendix 395 relating to the interrogation. There are notes in there that indicate that Colonel Pappas had authorized the interrogation techniques used in this case. Those notes are apparently written by Big Steve, as referred to as the interrogator in this case.
So did Colonel Pappas testify?
He did testify.
Did he indicate that he had given an order as described by you here today?
He could not remember, he could not explain those notes, Your Honor. He said, I cannot explain why that information is in those notes. Once again, that's an issue of credibility, Your Honor. Was Colonel Pappas telling the truth at that time? That the panel was never given that opportunity to determine whether Colonel Pappas was, in fact, telling the truth there.
And whose notes?
To make a credibility determination.
Whose notes were these?
These are Big Steve's, apparently Big Steve's, who's an interrogator for the CIA.
And how does that relate to knowledge by Smith?
Well, Smith's dog was being used in those interrogations. And Big Steve, in those notes, indicates that he received authorization for Colonel Pappas to use the dog in that interrogation of ASHI or Al-Qaeda. He's referred to as both in the record, Your Honor. So from that, there's a credibility issue that never really got to the panel because the panel was told this is an illegal order. They were told that the military judge didn't explain why he found the way he did, but he just said it's an unlawful order. He gave an unlawful order instruction.
Doesn't New hold that that's the judge's prerogative?
Well, Your Honor, New holds that, yes,
the legality of an order is an issue for the judge.
That's correct. It is an issue for the judge, but there's also a presumption that New addressed on the opposite side. The presumption in that case was that the presumption of the orders were legal. In this case, legal. In this case, the same presumption applies, presumption that the laws were legal, but in this case, it's the appellant that gets the shield of those lawful orders if he actually received those orders.
How do you know
whether he received those orders?
Go ahead. I don't see where you're going.
Whether he received those orders or not, Your Honor, is a question of fact.
Oh, okay. You're arguing you never received the order.
Well, we're arguing that the question of fact whether he received the order is out there was never addressed by this panel.
How do you deal with the muzzled, unmuzzled issue? All the charges deal with unmuzzled dogs.
That's correct, Your Honor. And once again, there is contradiction.
In your evidence, does it indicate whatever the order was that you say he received, it was to use an unmuzzled dog?
Well, Your Honor, once again, if you look at Big Steve's notes, it indicates that they were following what Colonel Pappas indicated was the correct way to do it. And that's from Big Steve's notes. Big Steve, of course, didn't testify in this case. Also, Major Danina stated...
Big Steve's notes reflect unmuzzled?
They don't reflect either, Your Honor. Also, Major Danina at Joint Appendix 172 said, generally, when they went to the hard site, they were not to keep their dogs muzzled, because that was exactly the opposite of what they were down there for. If something would happen, it would take too much time to unmuzzle the dog. Furthermore, Sergeant Hampton, Joint Appendix 193, I believe, also said that they didn't keep the dogs muzzled because the dogs being muzzled, the dogs breathe through their mouths, and that was not a good position for the dogs to be in. Furthermore, Sergeant Aston, Joint Appendix 147, said, we don't keep the dogs muzzled. There was a real question of fact of whether dogs were even down in a hard site muzzled. According to everybody that testified at this court-martial, they were not muzzled generally down in the hard site. And there was a real confusion about what orders were given by Colonel Pappas in this case.
Counsel, with respect to New, did New address the defense of obedience to orders, or was it a case involving violation of a lawful order?
In New, it was the violation of an order.
And isn't there language in the New opinion that talks about what it's not addressing and some of the issues that are reserved in that regard?
That's correct. In fact, your concurrence, Your Honor, goes into that very in-depth. It discusses some of the questions that are still out there regarding obedience orders and lack of obedience orders, and some of the fact-finding that needs to be done in those cases.
Now, with respect to this particular charge involving AJ, the charge is that appellant was involved in this offense by harassing and threatening Mr. AJ with his unmuzzled and barking and growling military working dog. Now, here we have an unmuzzled, barking and growling working dog. In terms of the facts that have been the subject of the questions, why don't you take a minute and lay out for us what the defense theory is as to the facts that led up to your client being next to Mr. AJ with a barking and growling military working dog. That is, what does the record establish as to how he got there and who, if anybody, ordered him to be there with a barking and growling unmuzzled dog?
First of all, Your Honor, Sergeant Fredericks, NCOIC of the working dog section during the day shift, he claims that they had this permission and that they had the permission to use the dogs. Also, Big Steve, in the notes, there's evidence that Big Steve believed that had asked for permission and received permission from Colonel Pappas. Colonel Pappas says, I don't remember giving that order, but that's still a credibility determination. Also, there's varying testimony between muzzling and not muzzling, whether they were ever muzzled in the hard site, whether it was proper to muzzle in the hard site at all.
My question doesn't go to the factual question as to whether there were or were not orders regarding muzzled or unmuzzled. Let's just assume right now that the charge is accurate, because we're talking about a defense here now. And the defense is that he was obeying an order. So I'm trying to figure out, with an unmuzzled, barking, growling, working dog, who gave him the order to be there? What does the record show about the chain of events that placed him in the cell during an interrogation or in prep for an interrogation with an unmuzzled barking dog?
Sergeant Frederick testified that they generally assisted the interrogators. Big Steve put in his notes that Sergeant Smith was in fact assisting in an interrogation. And in those interrogations, they made it clear that he were allowed the dogs bark. That's what they do. They're there to frighten the detainees. Colonel Pappas said that, on the other hand, he had an order that said that You couldn't do that unless they were Muslim. There is a factual dispute there that has not been resolved by this court.
You got an 06 given an order, and you got a Sergeant Frederick saying, nah, we didn't do it that way.
Yes, yeah.
Which do you obey?
Yeah, but the problem is there was no communication between Colonel Pappas and the appellant. The appellant was under Sergeant Frederick. He was obeying Sergeant
Frederick. Wasn't there something in the record that indicated that at one point he was in an audience with two or three others that Pappas said, do it this way?
Your Honor, Pappas remembers that he may have said that, but still, the record is unclear. It is clear that at one time, I believe it's Aspie, went in and talked to Colonel Pappas and came back with conditions that they could use, in fact, for a different interrogation. But Colonel Pappas could not remember this interrogation and what conditions he set for this interrogation.
Okay, going off on another tack, why isn't all of this just affirmatively waived? Defense counsel said at trial he had no objection to the instructions.
Your Honor, it's not affirmatively waived because this is an instruction that any defense, this is an affirmative defense, and any time there's an affirmative defense, and there is some evidence of it, it must be instructed upon. And legality
of orders. Well, he instructed on legality of orders.
He did but for he some made, of the charges, but not for this charge, Your Honor. He made the factual determination, the legal determination is unlawful, but in so doing, also made factual determinations, which were the province of the panel in this case.
And which factual determinations did he make that were improper here?
He made Colonel Pappas said that, first of all, he didn't give these orders. There's a credibility determination needs to be made by the panel in this case, Your Honor. The panel observed Colonel Pappas testifying. Colonel Pappas testified that he couldn't remember, but also we must remember that Colonel Pappas is also under investigation and testifying under grant of immunity in this case. So he has concerns of his own. So those credibility determinations, whether he gave an order or not, didn't give an order in this case, that's something for the panel to determine.
Do credibility determinations have anything to do with the judge's determination as to whether or not Colonel Pappas had the authority to give an order to use unmuzzled, barking, growling working dogs?
It doesn't in the circumstance with the well, it does too, Your Honor, because even Colonel Pappas said he thought he had the authority.
But if he thought he had the authority and was mistaken, does that mean that it was a lawful order?
It would
or
be lawful.
Does it mean that it's an unlawful order and that there would be a mistake with respect to obeying an unlawful order, believing it to be a lawful order?
Well, Your Honor, we believe that in assessing whether it's a lawful order, you have to look at it from the appellant, who is the little man on the totem pole in this case.
Well, no. I mean, it's either a lawful order or it's not a lawful order. The subjective belief of the appellant doesn't change that fact one way or the other.
Well, there is no indication. There is mixed questions in this case whether it was a lawful order or not. There are questions about that because nobody says that the dogs had to be muzzled at all times. There are questions regarding the muzzling. There are also questions regarding whether Colonel Pappas believed he had the authority. General Sanchez did not testify. Colonel Pappas did and said he had the authority. So those factual determinations must be made also by the military panel in this case. And it was not. So that is a factual determination that the panel had to make because Colonel Pappas says, I had the authority. I believed I had the authority.
Well, there's a difference between him having the authority and him believing that he had the authority, don't you think?
There is a difference, Your Honor, but once again, we have to look at this. The appellant, unless this is a palpably illegal order, he is bound to obey that order. And nothing in this record indicates that this is a palpably illegal order. In fact, the debate regarding...
Just to be clear, your link to the order from Pappas all has to go through Big Steve's notes, right?
Big Steve.
That's
Big
the
Steve.
Hinge on your case, in which this case...
Big Steve, and there is some other... Sergeant Frederick.
I just wanted to confirm that. I don't want to take you away from that question.
Sergeant Frederick as well, Your Honor. Sergeant Frederick testified that dogs were allowed to be used. And there is also other testimony regarding the muzzling that we believe is very important in this case.
But don't we have to assume, based on your argument, that there was an order here that was given to use the dog?
And we do have to assume that, Your Honor. And in fact, I think the government even assumes that there was an order. The clarity of where that order came from and those other questions, that's not in this case. But it appears that somebody gave Sergeant Smith, and at that time he wasn't even a sergeant, he was the low man on the totem pole of the dog handlers, an order to use his dog in a way to set conditions for an interrogation of Ashi, who was believed to be Al-Qaeda.
But the elements of a lawful order, one of them is that it was a communication to do a specific mandate. And here I don't see a specific mandate. I see a lot of speculation.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the notes, the specific mandate was to set conditions. Unfortunately, Big Steve did not testify in this case. That's a hole in the case that the appellant wishes wasn't there. But it's there for unfortunate reasons. But it is clear that Big Steve believed that he was giving authority in his mind for appellant to use a dog in that way. And that's another factual issue we are not aware of, because Big Steve had some authority over these dog handlers. Even Sergeant Frederick said that. They were told by Colonel Pappas to assist in setting conditions. And that's all the appellant did in this case, was assist in setting conditions.
Counsel,
it wasn't a palpably illegal order.
Just to clarify the record here, there's one reference in the record to a witness that the defense was not able to get. Witness was denied, the staff judge advocate, and also I believe a general officer. Was there anyone who was present during these circumstances that the defense wanted to have as a witness that the defense was not able to obtain?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. That
answers my question.
They did want Colonel Warren, but that was...
Right.
On issue three, what evidence is there in the record that as to which, if at all, which Geneva 3 or 4 that they were operating under?
There is no evidence, Your Honor, of that in the record. In fact, there is very little evidence regarding what the detainee status was in this case, and that's the appellant's complaint here. The detainee status.
There is no evidence in the record that the guards there were operating under a rubric of Geneva 3 or Geneva 4.
There is no evidence in the record, Your Honor, that links it to these two detainees, no.
Is there, in your view, may we take notice of what Geneva 3 and Geneva 4 say as to what the duties of internees or POWs are?
No, Your Honor. In our view, it has to be part of the record.
We may not take notice of the Geneva
Convention. No, we believe that it has to be proven before the fact finders in this case, and that would be submitting something that wasn't before the fact finders at the trial level. See, I'm out of time.
Are you making that argument because it's an element?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Major Karen Borgerding, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Martha Foss, I represent the United States in this case. The military judge properly instructed...
Was the judge's order ruling in fact correct? In order to use military working dogs to aid in military interrogations would be an unlawful order?
Yes, Your Honor.
General Sanchez could not have authorized military working dogs to be used in aid of military interrogations. That would have been unlawful?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. The government's position...
So it's not necessarily true that in order to use military working dogs would be an unlawful order?
Under the facts and circumstances of this case, and what the military judge used to make that ruling, that is the case, Your Honor.
So how would you read the judge's instruction?
The judge's instruction is
based solely on the facts in this case, it would be unlawful, or in order to use military working dogs to aid in military interrogations would be an unlawful order?
Based on solely on the facts in this case, Your Honor, the military judge made his threshold legal ruling as to the lawfulness of the order based on the fact that Lieutenant General Sanchez was the only person authorized to give the order to use military working dogs in aid in interrogations.
So why did he communicate that to the members? If that was part of his internal decision making as to whether he was going to give a particular instruction or not, why did he tell the members that the order was unlawful?
He did, Your Honor. That was part of his instruction. He gave the instruction that the order.
He told them that it was unlawful. And why did he do that?
Based on what was in the record and the facts in the record.
I understand that. My question is, what element or defense required him to tell the members that this order was unlawful? To amplify that, where in Rule for Court Martial 916D does the word unlawful appear?
Well, in the rule, Your Honor, the defense of obedience to orders can either be defense of obedience to lawful orders or defense of obedience to unlawful orders. And the decision as to whether or not...
Where does the word lawful appear in 916D?
In the discussion, Your Honor.
It's not in the rule, is it? There's absolutely nothing in the rule that brings before the members whether the order was lawful, is there?
In the rule, Your Honor. However, okay, there is a threshold decision that the military judge should make under Disher and New that as to the lawfulness of the order. And in this case, the military judge made that decision based on the facts in this case and the evidence.
That's not my question. The military judge normally does not spread before the members all of his reasoning as to why he makes a decision to give an instruction or not.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Where in 916 does it require the judge or even authorize the judge to tell the members that an order is unlawful?
Because the defense raised the defense of obedience to orders. And in that case, the military judge has to make the threshold decision, as in the discussion, as to whether or not the order was lawful or unlawful.
So he makes the decision, and then what does he instruct the members?
Then the instructions, depending on whether it is obedience to lawful orders or obedience to unlawful orders, is crafted accordingly. And that's exactly what the military judge did in this case. When he told the panel...
That's not what the rule says. The rule says that you get the, it doesn't say anything about lawful orders. You have a defense under 916 for an obedience to an order. Then the rule goes on to say you lose the defense if you knew the order to be unlawful, or a person of ordinary sense and understanding would know that the order is to be unlawful. Where in his instruction did the military judge tie this issue of who was competent to give this particular order, an order which the government says is not inherently illegal? Where did the judge instruct the members that, yes, there's an issue here as to whether someone was competent to give this order, and that's what's at issue here, not to leave the impression that this order was unlawful per se?
Your Honor, the military judge gave the proper instructions to the panel.
Why didn't it leave the impression with the members that the order was unlawful per se?
The threshold decision is a decision that should be made by the military judge, not the panel. Therefore, an explanation as to why he made that legal decision that is his to make does not need to be in the instructions.
So he can just leave the members with the impression that this is an inherently unlawful order, and that's okay?
He never said inherently unlawful.
I understand that. He said it was unlawful.
And he gave the proper instructions for obedience to an unlawful order. And in that instruction, he explained to the panel that they still must first find. I mean, his first explanation was that the panel still first must find, in order to convict appellant, beyond a reasonable doubt, that appellant was not acting pursuant to orders to use his military working dog to aid in interrogation. So they still got that instruction.
Where in the record does it establish that use of a military working dog in close proximity to a prisoner is maltreatment?
Well, under the testimony from the sergeant from Lackland Air Force Base that testified as to appellant's training as to military working dogs, he talked a lot about how safety was emphasized daily, and part of safety was maintaining control of the dog and maintaining control of a military working dog when in close proximity to other animals or other people.
I understand that, but the government has said on page 14, footnote 13, that this order was not illegal per se, that is, the conduct of using a working dog in close proximity to a prisoner is not illegal per se. Where in the record does it establish that it is maltreatment of a prisoner to use a working dog in close proximity to a prisoner?
Well, there's two separate things, Your Honor. What the government is saying is that the use of military working dogs at Abu Ghraib, in general, is not per se illegal, and that's not what the record reflects, that's not what the instruction reflects, and that's not the government's position today. The government's position today, that appellant's specific use of his military working dog without a muzzle in close proximity to the prisoner in the manner in which he did, and as shown by the pictures in at Joint Appendix 280, 280, 282, that use was illegal, it was unlawful, that specific use, although that really doesn't reflect on the specific issue before the court, which is why the military judge's ruling was correct. And it's the government's position that that ruling was correct. He gave the proper instruction.
The issue of the lawfulness of what was done is an issue in the order. And my question is, where does the record establish that an interrogator cannot ask a military dog handler to place a dog in close proximity to a prisoner and have that dog bark and muzzled?
Well, in the record, in this particular record, Your Honor, they couldn't do it because General Sanchez didn't authorize it. General Sanchez...
Excuse me, counsel. That's a question of whether General Sanchez had a particular communication with his subordinates. As a matter of this defense, the defense of whether the person had a reasonable, knew that the orders were unlawful, or a person of ordinary and sense and understanding would know that they were unlawful, where does the record establish that it is maltreatment to use a dog in close proximity to a prisoner?
Again, Your Honor, it's the Colonel Pappas's original order when he actually did give the order in mid-December, not with respect to Mr. Al-Jahashi, but in earlier December, he gave the order and he said that muzzles were to be used inside the interrogation booth, which is in close proximity.
Is appellant charged with violating an order from Colonel Pappas or General Sanchez?
And as you were discussing earlier, there really was no order in this case.
He's charged with maltreatment. Where's the evidence that would establish a standard that this conduct is maltreatment?
Well, Your Honor, the government's position is that any United States soldier who has a detainee in their control, and that detainee cannot get up and leave, that detainee cannot make decisions for himself, that detainee is under the control of the United States government, and that is appellant in this case, as a military police and as a military dog handler, that when he allows his military working dog, not only just to get in close proximity of the detainee, but he allowed his military working dog to get in the face of the detainee, possibly even to remove the hood off of the detainee, as shown again in Joint Appendix 281, that is maltreatment, that it was doing for the express purpose of terrorizing and scaring this individual.
So is it the position of the United States government that no United States government interrogator can authorize a dog handler to get a dog in the close proximity of a detainee unmuzzled and barked, as was done in this case?
Not based on the facts of this case, Your Honor, no. They can't. One, because General Sanchez needed to give that order, but even if General Sanchez did give that order, which he obviously did not in this case, the order would be for the dog to be under the control of the handler at all times and muzzled while in the interrogation booth, which...
I understand, this will be my last question in this regard. So it's the position of the United States that no interrogator, that it would be a crime for any interrogator to ask a dog handler to do what was done in this case under the charge, and that is put a dog in close proximity unmuzzled to a prisoner. That's the position.
Under the facts of this case, that's the position of the government, Your Honor.
Counsel, was that element described to the members during the judge's instructions? The requirement that the accused was cruel toward or oppressed or maltreated the person?
Yes, Your Honor. The government gave the military judge gave the proper instruction, not only as to maltreatment, but as to the issue before this court as to whether or not the proper instruction was given as to the defense of obedience to orders. And that proper instruction was given, not only that appellant In order to find the appellant guilty, they needed to find beyond a reasonable doubt that he was not acting pursuant to orders. But the military judge then went on to explain that with an unlawful order, they had to find beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant knew the order was unlawful, or that a person of ordinary sense, common sense, would have known that order to be unlawful. Again, an order, what we're talking about here, was never given.
Has the appellant ever challenged the legal sufficiency of the maltreatment charge on the basis that it couldn't be maltreatment? Or did they challenge it solely on the grounds that it couldn't be maltreatment because of the person, not because of the nature of the act?
The question before this court, Your Honor, is legal sufficiency as to whether or not the detainee was subject to the orders of appellant, and not necessarily whether the actual treatment was maltreatment. And the government's position on that, although not before this court, is that it absolutely was maltreatment to treat this detainee in that manner.
Counsel, where would we be if in fact General Sanchez did not give this order, but that everybody at the facility thought that he had given the order, and everybody at the facility operated under that impression?
Well, that's where the instruction comes in, Your Honor, that the military judge properly gave. If General Sanchez did not give this order, it was an unlawful order because it was not given by the proper authority. He withheld that decision to use military working dogs to his own personal decision. He did not give that order, and therefore, it was an unlawful order.
However, the
instruction incorporates that. Again, the panel was told that if they felt that appellant was acting pursuant to orders and that he did not know the order was unlawful, or the ordinary person, and again, if everyone in the compound felt that it was a lawful order, then he would have been acquitted. But they had that information before them, both from the facts presented in the case as well as a proper instruction by the military judge.
If we were to find that the judge's instruction was in fact incorrect when it stated that in order to use military working dogs aid in military interrogations, if you find such an order was given, which is to say in order to use military working dogs aid in military interrogations, would be an unlawful order, if we determined based on our review of General Sanchez's overarching direction as to what ultimately could be permitted if he authorized it, where does that leave your position vis-a-vis whether appellant was prejudiced by the instruction?
Well, the government argued that there was no prejudice beyond reasonable doubt because appellant was not acting pursuant to a lawful order to use the military working dogs in aid of interrogation. In other words, assuming that the military judge was incorrect and that he should have given the instruction that the order was lawful, his instruction would have been that, again, the panel
not
had to find beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes, it would be more nuanced. It's not one or the other. It's one that takes into account the actual structure of the command orders that were in operation at the time.
If this court would rule that the military judge gave the incorrect instruction, there is no prejudice
with respect to this sentence that I just read.
Okay, Your Honor. Appellant still is not acting. For the defense of obedience of orders to apply, regardless of the lawfulness of the order, the panel still has to find beyond a reasonable doubt that appellant was not acting pursuant to a lawful order in this case. And given the facts of this case, he was not, for the reasons we have discussed. It's because he allowed his unmuzzled dog in close, and when I say close proximity, I don't mean even in the same room. I mean in the face, inches away from a detainee, potentially even taking off the hood from his head. These things not only go against the guidance in General Sanchez's policy, the left and right limits, as it was termed, of Colonel Pappas's, the order that he did give, not the one in this case, but the one earlier, as well as the details on appellant's training, as far as the safety concerns for the military working dog.
Counsel, doesn't that then get you back to the questions that I was asking before? That is, your argument at that point then is that under no circumstances could a dog handler respond to an order of another person to provide the dog in this close proximity during interrogation because it's inherently illegal, and every dog handler would know that it's inherently illegal. Is that your position?
Exactly, Your Honor. Under the circumstances of this case, let's say, and there is even some information in there that Staff Sergeant Frederick, it isn't clear exactly what he told him, but he did testify that he told the appellant to put the dogs on the detainee. And if he were specifically telling the appellant to put the dog unmuzzled inches from the guy's face, that is unlawful, given the training, given the orders from Colonel Pappas, given General Sanchez's policies, given the Geneva Conventions that Colonel Pappas talked about. That is never allowed. That is maltreatment.
Okay, so anytime a U.S. interrogator places a dog in proximity to a detainee, it violates, in barks like this, it violates the Geneva Conventions. Is that the government's position?
Not simply that it's in proximity in barks. The government is not prepared to take a position on the overall use of the military.
You're focusing on whether the dog was muzzled or unmuzzled, are you not?
Well, the muzzling comes in from where General Sanchez's policy is and Colonel Pappas.
Talking about the Geneva Conventions, is it a violation of the Geneva Conventions to put an unmuzzled dog barking in close proximity to a detainee during interrogation?
I mean, the record doesn't really reflect specifically.
What's the government's position?
The government's position on that is that under the facts of this case and what the appellant did and what is shown in the pictures that are contained in the record, that act was unlawful, and that any order to do that specific act appellant would have known to be unlawful, or that the ordinary, the government's position is that the appellant knew that to be unlawful. So if he's following specific orders from then Staff Sergeant Frederick to have his dog treat the detainee in that manner, those would be unlawful orders, and the defense of obedience to orders would not be available.
And the source for the illegality is guidance that he received in Texas when he was getting his dog training. What's the source of the illegality that any reasonable soldier would know?
Well, not only his training and the various policies, but maltreatment itself. He was charged with harassing and threatening Mr. Al-Jahassi with his unmuzzled barking dog, and that constitutes maltreatment.
If
his behavior constitutes
maltreatment. I'm sorry, I have a question. What does the record reflect as to whether the soldiers were operating under Geneva 3, Geneva 4, or Geneva at all?
I don't believe the record reflects that. Colonel Pappas does reference the Geneva Conventions, but he doesn't get into the specifics of which convention they were
operating. Is it or is it not relevant then to this court as we look at this issue as to what the Geneva Conventions provide?
You know, the government's position is that it's not relevant because this court is looking at the legal decision, the legal determination by the military judge on the threshold question of the lawfulness or the unlawfulness.
And I'm asking also with respect to the legal sufficiency of the maltreatment counts as to whom was subject to whose orders, if at all.
And Your Honor, with respect to the third issue on the subject of orders, as said in United States versus Carson, the essence of maltreatment is abuse of authority.
I'm just asking you the Geneva Convention question. So your answer is not relevant. Oh, by the way, we will rely on something else. But I'm just asking you the Geneva Convention question here. Is it in or out? Or with respect to the first element of maltreatment?
It's not relevant, Your Honor, because it's an objective viewpoint.
And it was not presented, and it was not, is it, do you share the appellant's view that it was not presented in this case as evidence?
Not as evidence, in respect, Your Honor,
that's,
no.
That's all I'm asking on that question. And then you would, your evidence, therefore, is what occurs on page 26 of your brief, which is testimony of Sergeant First Class Hathaway and the testimony of Private Frederick.
As to
whether the detainees, internees, or whomever they were subject to the orders of the military working dog handlers.
Yes, well, Your Honor, it would be the testimony of Private Frederick as well as the SOP guidance that an appellant was given. I don't know that Sergeant Hathaway, I think he was the trainer, I don't know that he had anything to say about the subject to orders. But Private Frederick, who was also a guard, testified that they were subject to the orders. And again, it's objective. Standard, not a subjective standard. The detainee felt about following orders, whether or not he wanted to follow orders, whether or not he felt he had to follow orders, is not relevant for this particular issue.
You answered my question. Thank you.
Your time has expired, and with indulgence of my colleagues, and this may be repetitive, I am trying to pin down here, from my understanding, what the source is. In response to the question of if the judge erred in not fully describing the context in which the order was unlawful, and the question of prejudice arose, the government's response was there would be no prejudice because any soldier would know that this was an unlawful order. That is, it was an unlawful order to place a dog in this close proximity under the circumstances of this case to the detainee. Is that an accurate statement of the government's position as to the issue of prejudice if the judge erred in his instruction?
The first position of the government is that there's no prejudice because appellant wasn't acting pursuant to any order.
Understand.
He was doing things on his own. The second part of what you said is that, yes, if any soldier would know that this particular action was unlawful and therefore the defense of obedience of orders would not be available, and he would be guilty of maltreatment without that defense of obedience.
And what is the source of the proposition that any soldier would know that this order was unlawful, assuming an order was given?
Any soldier with the training that appellant had and the experience that appellant had. Although the government would also argue that the pictures speak for themselves.
I understand. Thank you very much for clarifying that. If you want to briefly conclude, please do so.
Yes, Your Honor. The military judge properly instructed the panel in appellant's case as to the defense of obedience of orders. He correctly ruled that an order to use military working dogs in aid of interrogations was unlawful, and he was not required to give an instruction as to obedience of orders for specification 5 of charge 1. Appellant was properly convicted of maltreating Mr. Al-Jahashi. The government asks that the court affirm the decision of the Army Court in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir. Nowhere in this record did the government establish that the use of the working dog for interrogations, as was done in this case, was per se illegal or palpably illegal or in any other way illegal. Also in this case, the maltreatment simply was not proven. The government did not put on enough evidence to establish that maltreatment occurred in this case.
Counsel, I believe one of the questions earlier asked whether the issue of fact legal sufficiency of maltreatment is raised under the issues that the defense has assigned in this case and granted by this court.
Your Honor, we would submit that it is, but we would be more than happy to do further briefing on
that. That's not my question. My question
is
what brings the issue of legal sufficiency of the evidence before the court at this time?
Issue 3, Your Honor.
Issue 3 is a different issue there. Issue 3 is an issue dealing with the relationship between the detainees and the appellant. Issue 1... in terms of whether that has any bearing on legal sufficiency into the terms that you've raised it, is a different issue. And that
That's
is whether the evidence establishes the maltreatment aspect. Issue 3 only addresses the relationship aspect. What in the granted issues brings the maltreatment aspect in terms of legal sufficiency before the court at this time?
Also issue 1, Your Honor, because in this case the prejudice that the appellant suffered because of the improper instruction was the fact that he was convicted in a case where there was not sufficient evidence to affirm this conviction. And that's where issue 1 and issue 3, the defense would submit, brings that to bear, and especially issue 1 in this case.
What's your response to the government's argument that, and it's a tic-tac-toe thing, if that sentence in the judge's instructions is in fact erroneous, the government's argument, arguing in the alternative, is that it's nonetheless not prejudicial to impel it because any soldier with his training and expertise would know that it's inherently unlawful to use the dogs in that manner.
The record, Your Honor.
And then your response to that is?
The record does not establish that, Your Honor, that is inherently unlawful palpably illegal. In fact, the record establishes that the appellant in this case was not trained in interrogation techniques, had no training in interrogation techniques whatsoever.
But he's trained in dog handling.
He was trained
in this is dog handling.
Now, let me ask you, what if the record, this is just for the sake of developing the argument, what if the record is, what if there were, the record reflected that there was orders making it clear that any use of an unmuzzled dog was unlawful? Asking you to argue in the alternative, not...
If the record established that use of any muzzled dog was unlawful, if that were the case, then that would be something else that the members would have to determine, but that's not the case here because we have plenty of testimony that says that, in fact...
If that were the case, how would you be prejudiced by the fact that the judge gave an erroneous instruction?
Because, once again, the government's theory in this case, even before this court, is that the way the dog, it doesn't matter what the facts establish, if the dog is used in that way, it's palpably illegal. But then they say, on the other hand, it's not per se illegal. So our position is they haven't established that the standard of care was violated in any way in this case by the appellant.
With respect to the instruction, if the judge should have given a more nuanced instruction with respect to the nature of the authority to issue the order and did not do so, the defense offered no objection at that time. Does that place us in a plain error situation?
It does not, Your Honor, because this is an affirmative defense and there was some evidence that the obedience to order instruction should have been given.
That's a different issue. I'm only talking about the issue of whether the subpart of that issue, if the judge misstated or did not completely state the nature of the illegality of the order. If that's the error in the case and the defense did not object, why are we not in a plain error situation?
Your Honor, we don't believe it's plain error, but even under the plain error standard, we believe that we should still prevail because it's just clear from this record that the military judge misdirected the members as to a defense that was out there and was available to the appellant in this case. What the appellant did was not palpably illegal in this case, at least regarding ASHI and Specification 3. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:25 a.m.
Awesome.